Hi, this is Roy.
And this is Dave from No Use for Name.
You're listening to the Talking Records Podcast.
Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records. Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track-by-track breakdown of all the songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety.
Hey folks, welcome back to another episode of Talking Records. My name is Jed, and you're listening to a podcast devoted to digging deep into great albums. I'm here with my good friend Craig. How's it going, buddy?
What's up, Jed? Thanks for having me back on the show.
Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, anytime, buddy.
I don't know how I get you to keep coming back.
You can't get rid of me.
Yeah. Craig, I am beyond pleased to be joined today by Rory and Dave from No Use for a Name. Anyone who knows me knows how much I absolutely adore this band and how much they mean to me. I love this band since I first heard them in 1996 and have pounced on each release since then. When Feel Good Record of the Year came out, anticipation for this record was so incredibly high for me. It had been 3 years since their previous record, and what we got with this record was a huge leap forward in songwriting, song structures, complexity, instrumentation. I was just blown away.
Yeah, Jed, absolutely. When you first introduced me to No Use for a Name on one of those famous mixtapes they used to make for me, I was instantly hooked. The songs, the style, Tony's singing, the drumming, everything all around just made this band just one of my go-tos, one of my favorites. And then this album here, the Feel Good Record of the Year, it's a great album. What can we say, you know?
What can you say? All right, but first, let's take care of some upfronts.
Be sure to follow Talking Records on social media. We can be found on Instagram at Talking Records Podcast. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and even YouTube. Give us a like or a follow, and we'll try to keep fresh content coming your way daily. You can also visit our website by going to TalkingRecordsPodcast.com. There you will find episodes, merch, and more. You can even drop us an email at TalkingRecords@Outlook.com. These are all great ways for us to connect with you over all the great music we enjoy. We would love to get this podcast in front of even more music lovers, and you can help by providing us with a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume podcasts, as every review helps us reach more listeners. Thanks, everyone, and let's continue with the podcast.
All right, Craig, I want to get into this. Here is our conversation with Rory and Dave from No Use for a Name on Feel Good Record of the Year. All right, so we are here with Rory and Dave from No Use for a Name. How's it going, guys?
Terrific.
What's happening?
Not a whole lot. We are super thrilled to have a chance to talk with you guys about Feel Good Record of the Year, a fantastic record that you guys made.
I'm excited to talk about it. I got some stories. Rory, you got any stories? I can remember you.
I got some stories.
So, Rory, man, what have you been up to? What's new?
A lot of work, just getting through this damn pandemic, not playing music, just not. I've had a couple band practices with a band I play with, but just working, getting, it's like the trogs of life, just getting through it. But this gets me excited, just talk about a pretty awesome time in my life, and No Use for Name's time of Feel Good Record of the Year. So happy to talk about it. I've been looking forward to it since we talked a few weeks ago, Jeb.
Yeah. And Dave, how you been keeping busy, man?
I'm out here living in Nashville and
nice.
Teaching guitar lessons and playing with a dude out here, which has been, you know, like up until this year, kind of keeping me busy. But so this year we've been doing a little bit here and there, fortunately, when we can, but just been doing a lot of guitar lessons and kind of hanging out and taking lessons myself and trying to not annoy my wife, basically. It's kind of what I'm up to, man. I'm like a, you know, she's my sugar mama over this period. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I'm just like keep myself busy because all she does is see me nap.
Yeah.
I can do 5 guitar lessons in a day, and that's a good day for me, but I'm still, like, sleeping at some point, and she's not, you know what I mean?
Right. So you're teaching guitar, like, over Zoom lessons, or how are you doing that?
I do it on Skype or FaceTime,
nice.
Usually.
Nice. Yeah.
So people have been great about it, man. You know, there's been, all walks of life, you know, doing it. So it's been honestly a great way to talk to people and still have communication with people over the past year too.
So yeah, stay good. In touch with other humans. It's been good.
Yeah.
It also seems like a good opportunity for, not promotions, but like getting yourself out there to do something musically when you can't actually physically leave your house. It's pretty, pretty neat.
For sure. And, you know, there's, Rory knows. I mean, like, Rory started his business back when we were in No Use for Name, and I started teaching back when we were in No Use for Name, and that was kind of a conscious thing we both decided to do, right, Rory? Like, I remember we talked about it. It was like, we need to find something else to do to make the pressures of the band kind of go away, you know? It made it more fun to be on the road when, you know, you didn't have to sweat it if things weren't going to be super great, you know? So that was something we kind of started getting going. And that was something we bonded over for sure, because we tried to build it up as we could while we were on the road.
All right, guys, well, let's jump right into Feel Good Record of the Year.
Sleep is also known as I'm awake. Addicted to the easy life that everybody hates. I wonder, should I call you or just stare in space again?
All right, it had been 3 years since Keep Them Confused, an album Tony had gone on record stating his unhappiness with in terms of sound. What was the game plan for Feel Good Record of the Year?
You know, Feel Good was the most rehearsed record, I thought, like, at least in my tenure with him. There was a cool feeling about it because the songs were so solid, I thought, right out of the gate, and I'm sure Roy would agree with me on this stuff. And, like, the way we rehearsed was really cool. Like, we had our in-ears, like, right, Roy, remember in the rehearsal place, we had, like, our in-ear set up, and Matt got all into, like, making sure we had a cool mix so we could record practice all the time. And then we would go back to Tony's, and we'd listen to rehearsals, and we would, like, really work all the parts and stuff. So we were really excited, it seems like, to me, like, going back. I remember feeling he was pretty anal at that time about what was going on, you know. He was really picky about it in particular, but it wasn't anything out of the ordinary. And I thought we were all pretty sharp on our game at the time.
Well, I'd like to say I felt it was, of the 27 years that the band was together, it was the first time that everything was truly firing in all cylinders. It was definitely a really fine-tuned machine. We were all mature. The songs, I also felt as a whole, were the best. I think the sounds we were coming up with were the best. And I think the thing that really showed when we were in the practice rooms is how much everyone got to be creative and bring as much as they wanted to the table. Tony was writing the songs, but it was the first time that everyone was just, with the 3 or 4 albums that we did with Dave and Matt, that everyone was just equal playing field. We were all bringing our A game, and it was a conscious effort. And because I think we were recording just about every practice with mics in a really controlled room, almost like a, you know, live mixing room, that we could really listen to it under the microscope and hear what we were doing and say, hey, can we change this, tweak that, make this.
That's awesome.
And we were able to play around with that. So it was the first time that the band, we really were critical of what we were doing. And we wanted to build the best album we could, you know, just a long run. We didn't have anything thinking, oh, it's going to end soon. It was like, for some reason, everything lined up, and it's rare for that to happen to a band and Feel Good. I do believe that going into it, I didn't know it was going to be the best album, but it seemed like as we were building it at the Blasting Room and Fort Collins, that it was coming together to be the best album that we did. And it's so easy to say that, but I just knew that musicmanship and the songs were so good, just experience, right? And then the situation that we had in the recording studio was so supportive. I mean, I went into a recording studio, there was 5 people working there, they're all drummers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had this thing, I'm like, I had the support group going into this album that I wanted to do the best I'd ever done. And you always think that and say that, but I felt like, because I was practicing so much and we had such an easy, but we were practicing so much. I think it was 2 weeks on, a week off or something like that. We did that for months. And then we went into the studio as a band, only the band. And then we went into this amazing environment, and that's Feel Good Record of the Year.
Yeah, but there's another part to that too, Roy, which is totally funny, because we practiced our butts off and we went through all that stuff, and we show up the first day and Bill goes, okay, you guys are going to demo the record.
No.
And
we're like, oh no.
That's right.
Right? And we're like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, you're going to like play it and then we're going to make changes. And we're just like, like we totally were thrown by that at first. And then we did the first 3 days. We played the record live.
Oh, wow.
And we went through and he like fine tuned everything from that point on, I remember. And it was like, and keep in mind too, like Bill Stevenson, who's not super excited to work with Bill. So like, it was just that was freshness, I think, to it too, where everybody was like really excited. And the blasting room works an interesting way. The drums get done, then it goes and the bass gets put on it in another room, and then you start getting guitars on it. So like you have this circle of stuff happening where like things are getting done all the time. People are always working and you're staying there, you know? So, it's a cool environment to be creative.
There wasn't that typical downtime where like one person's jamming out, playing a song, and everybody else is just kind of hanging around the studio waiting for something else to do. You guys actually stayed busy the whole time.
Yeah, not at all. So the way that worked is I was recording my drums and I was finishing a song. And we go, okay, I think we got it. And as soon as we have it, Matt's laying his bass on it. And as soon as Matt was done with his bass, rhythm guitars were on it. And as soon as that was happening, and because there was like three or four engineers, all super good, Bill Stevenson and Jason Livermore pretty much were, you know, in control of that. But, you know, they're doing cleanup and stuff in the other room. So it was just like a big, very productive circle the way it went on. And, and we were so practiced and we knew what we were doing. The songs were there that it was just easy. There was no guesswork anymore because we came so prepared. Yeah. I was going to say, I would be surprised that any band came in as prepared as we were for that album.
So I picked up something you guys were saying earlier. You guys used to record your practices and then listen back to it again. So like the sports teams would go in and do a practice and you go back and critique yourself later.
That's such a good tool to be able to do something like that.
Absolutely.
If too many people at the time were kind of really doing a lot of that kind of stuff, I mean, maybe, but like because we had the gear in the room and it was easy to dissect it in that way. And Matt just kind of had the idea of like, hey, you know, I think we can break this down. And you know, that Matt was really good for stuff like that. And, you know, as soon as it's to be said too, as soon as Rory and I get done, Matt and Tony stay there for a while and hammer stuff out together, you know. Mm-hmm. That's where like they decorated up like a Christmas tree and do all the other stuff. I just remember when Roy tracked his drums, having Livermore there, dude, I remember you were so excited, Roy. You were so excited because you felt like he was like, he was a player, you know, and Livermore would be back there going, come on, man, come on. And you'd be doing, cause you had that huge snare roll at the beginning of what's that fucking song, man, that goes forever.
Whatever.
Yeah,
I don't remember it.
Sleep is the same as I'm awake. I know what song you're thinking of.
I just remember Rory back there dying, you know, like doing like ever. And you know, it was cool, man. It's fun. Man, it was a good time of working with those guys, no doubt.
Keeping with that whole drum theme for a minute, Rory, you know, being a drummer myself, I like to listen to albums and pick up on the drums and the tones and stuff like that. And this album, you can definitely hear the kick drum, you know, punching through, and I like hearing that clean, concise kick drum when drummers are playing. Now, for this record, was there anything different kit-wise that you did, or was it just kind of like business as usual, you know, same thing, let's do it, rock out?
Yeah, that's funny. So we were talking about that before we went in the studio, and I said, do I need to bring my drums? And they said, you can bring your drums, or we got a bunch of stuff. I'm thinking, yeah. Fucking Bill Stevenson.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a bunch. Bill Stevenson has drums. Yeah.
and we go there, and there's just some drum sets in the room set up. And they said, you can play that one. You can just sit behind that one if you like it. We can change anything out. And the drum set was just there. I don't even know. It was all different pieces. I think I put my cymbals on there, and that was it. I didn't use my snare, my kick. So it was just some really kind of generic pieced up kit, but it sounded good and it was easy to play. I mean, you know, any drummer sits behind a drum set, it's either easy or not. And I didn't change anything. I just kind of went and we started playing. So, you know, for me, it was, there was no conscious effort. I figured, like, after we demoed for those couple days at the beginning, and I realized that there's five drummers in that place, I'm like, I'm like a baby being taken care of right now.
It wasn't intimidating at all?
No, because these guys were so nice and so supportive, and they wanted what we wanted. They wanted the best album and the best performance that we could all do. And it shined through, and any band that got to go there, I'm sure, has the same story. The most supportive environment and creative, and it makes a band be a band there. And, you know, we were a band that came in there, you know, all business, and then it topped it off by having that support group there. We did five albums before that with Ryan Green. Mm-hmm. It was the same thing, best experience you can have, but it was one dude. So it was a little bit slower, and Ryan was the man. And yeah. After five albums, we just needed the change. So the change, when that opportunity came, it's like that's what we wanted to do. And we didn't really have any conscious effort to, you know, set for, you know, a goal, but just we wanted to be there. And thank gosh. And that's this album.
Well, it came out great. And so I kind of have a few more questions just about going into the record. So you guys are talking about how you really approach this one from a more collaborative standpoint. So as you're rehearsing, as you're recording your rehearsals, you start to notice that, you know, some of the songs are maybe a little different, more complex. You've got some slower paced stuff happening. Standing on lines that you never wanna cross. Better listen to the balls. I know you're lonely too. Sleeping between trucks, thinking of you. Was this just like something that organically happened, or was there like a plan to sort of step out a little bit?
I think it was what I really think, like, yeah, because there is some different songs on there, you know, like Sleep Between Trucks and and stuff like that. And I know that, like, it was nice to bring that element in there. There was actually a piano version of a song that was done. We tried some different things. Remember that, Roy? There was like a song that was sent off to a dude in LA that played piano.
I do remember that.
And I mean, when we heard it back, it was ridiculous. It was like crazy. It might have been it might have been like something like Sleep Between Trucks or something like that. I don't even know. But it was just like, Bill was like, hey, I know this dude. Let's see what he does with this. And we sent it off to him, and he sent it back. And it was like if Elton John did what a Jones did. You know?
Yeah, it was like, unbelievable.
That's cool.
It was crazy. But it was too much, you know. And yeah, I remember, man, we got to do that. And like Tony was just like, man, that's just like, that'll throw people for a loop. And, you know, there was an element to push it. And I think as you saw the songs come together, you just kind of had to trust it. I'll admit, I didn't understand as much as I do now what it's like to look at a record as a whole picture, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was probably pretty focused on what I was doing individually and like really trying, because Tony did write everything. So, you know, trying to get in parts when you could and making sure things fit and all that. You know, I might have been a little more self-aware, unfortunately, than looking at everything. I do remember thinking a couple of the songs were kind of weird, you know. Mm-hmm. I do remember thinking a couple of songs were kind of weird, but now I listen back to them and they're like my favorite ones, you know. So
yeah, and they fit together really well. I was going to ask, was there ever a point when anyone was kind of like, wow, we're making kind of a different record here, guys?
I'd say a couple things on that. It had been 3 years since the album before that. And I think we always try to make something, do something a little bit different and progressive for us. And, you know, we have the tools we have. And that was the four guys in the band, you know, getting better at our instruments, because we toured like crazy between those two albums. I mean, it was a serious amount of touring. And we were touring right up until we recorded, right until we started practicing for this album, if you remember that, Dave. So we were already on track to be, you know, good at our instruments. And then, you know, going into it, the practice, just we were practicing so much. It was like playing live every day, and we were just everyone's chops were good. I wanted to add something. Something interesting happened before we went into the studio. We had 12 songs, and Tony sent a CD. We were still sending CDs, not even digital. We sent it to the studio.
Yeah.
And Bill Stevenson told Tony, I don't think you've written the first side of the first song to the album yet.
Oh, really? Wow.
And he had written that song, and we got that. I remember being at Tony's house, and it was a speakerphone. I was there with, I don't remember if you were there or not, but I remember sitting there with Tony, and Tony went, and I just saw him be challenged. And that night he wrote The Biggest Lie.
And that is such an amazing song and such an incredible opener.
Yeah, and that was the opening song. It was crazy how just easy it came to Tony one. Wow. But that Bill Stevenson pretty much challenged Tony. And when someone challenged Tony to songwriting, it's like he was up for that challenge. I mean, that's one thing that he could just do is when put under pressure, he was able to write these songs. And that was the song. And it was just a neat thing that happened. And to see it happen, Clear Eyes was special. Kind of, you know?
Yeah, definitely. That song just like jumped off the record when I first put this album in after getting it when it came out. And I remember after hearing that song, I was like, whoa, like it was very clear, you know, whether it was the Blasting Room or whether it was, you know, the super extended touring you guys were doing, you just sounded locked in and sounded amazing.
I will say that Biggest Lie is probably one of my favorite New Fan songs.
Cool. Want to hear something else cool about that song? We were on tour. I don't remember where we were. We drove all night to get to Minneapolis to do that, to do the video for that.
Oh, yeah.
And we drove. We literally got to the place where we were doing the video at 7 in the morning. We were just toast. We were on tour. We're tired. I was probably sick. Yeah. And I don't remember how we found out about the guy. I don't even remember the guy's name. It was a great experience. But we were there at 7 o'clock. By 8 o'clock, we were playing the song in some weird studio behind a green screen.
That's hilarious. Totally forgot about it. Two people were sick, right?
I was sick. I was always sick on tour.
Yeah. Funny. I totally forgot about it. A story about Biggest Lie. The thing I think about Biggest Lie is, Rory, were you there when I did my guitar solo for that?
I don't remember. If I was, I was probably in the other room because they were trying to, you know, that's how that was operating.
Whenever I did any of my stuff, I always made sure Matt was there for one. Because if it went on record and Matt was in the room, I had somebody else playing. And Matt had really good ears. So I figured always like my safe code. But I remember doing that solo, Tony, and I got in a huge argument with that solo. Because, like, he didn't, like, there was confusion between, it's safe to say that I was probably not playing the same thing that I had done at his house. And, like, he's like, you're doing the same thing that you did at my house. And I'm like, I don't know
what the hell I did.
Yeah, and he's just, we're, like, going back and forth, and I shit you not. So, like, there's a little part in the solo that's, like, quick. And I lined up two beers on the console and I looked at Livermore and I said, if I'm drinking this second beer and we're still doing this, so we're, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I reached to grab the, like one of the beers and I'm drinking it. And I just start playing that with my left hand and Livermore punches me in. And so that fast part is me slamming a beer while that, and then he cuts it in the solo and Tony turns around and goes, that's it. And I'm like,
that's amazing.
I was like, I was just goofing off. And he's all, well, that's keeping it. And then like, that's good stuff, man. You know, like that's the joke was back then is like, you know, you got to do what you got to do to make a good record. So, you know, pulling that's a fun story for me looking back at it.
Along those same lines, I have something else that was strange. So we mentioned that we were recording in our own separate rooms, essentially, and the digital recording would go to the next room and then the next guy would be doing it. Well, I did two songs in a row. I don't remember what they were, but I recorded two songs with Bill behind the board. I was in the drum room. I knew what I was going to do. Bill knew what I was going to do, and I had to do it. And we changed a couple things. And Tony goes, you know, and then finally Tony heard it after we recorded the two songs because Tony was in another room recording what he was doing, his rhythms. And it comes out and Tony goes, that's different. What did you do? And I'm like, I think I went to the ride before the intro or before the solo. And I kept this, you know, kick simpler in this part. He's like, that's really smart because that's the theme of the song. And we didn't even think about that. And it was just one of those things that it was so productive, and we were just able to be creative and do our own thing, each in a different room. So when I came up with this, and we left it as is, and so Dave, you didn't get away with that with a solo with Tony, but I did get away with a couple changes on my parts, and he didn't say anything. He didn't catch it until he's like, "Why is that different?" And I explained it to him. He's like, "That's really smart." But I didn't come up with that on my own, which, you know, is something we just worked with Bill on, and it made sense to do it. And we didn't ask, you know, Tony or Matt. And Matt and Tony, those guys were so particular. They could hear everything before it even was coming. Mm-hmm. They could hear something getting weak. They could hear something speeding up. They could hear something, you know, I'm hitting with my purse. and they would go, you know, they'd be the first ones to pick up on. They were so hypersensitive. They just had amazing musical ears. And lucky for us, you know, that you had someone that was so critical and cared so much about it, because their ears were way better than mine. And, you know, I'm just.
And
I'm,
Bill I'm, and it, Jason was just.
yeah. There's no room for error there.
Yeah. Wow. Like a loaded gun, if it sits too long, eventually you work up the nerve to abandon your herd. We got these remedies for insecurities that nobody is listening. And all the while, I've heard the recording of this album described as fun to make, easy, and more organic. So what was different, you know, this time around than, say, perhaps previous records? Or
no ego.
No ego. All right.
Yeah.
Everybody went in with an open mind. It's like the first time we were just comfortable with each other, comfortable with ourselves, comfortable with our ability to play our instruments, and we had good supporting from the record label. There was no issues there. It wasn't like we had to come up with, you know, X amount of tens of thousands of dollars for the album. Everything was just kind of sort of business as usual, and we were so practiced. I think everyone felt confident in the next guy's ability. Usually, you know, myself as a drummer, three guitar players in the band, one drummer. I was always a little bit, scared of what I was bringing, because it's one drummer and three guitar players going, "What are you doing? Hit harder, hit faster, hit this, that." There was just a moment of peace where everyone just let me do my thing. And I felt like it was the first time I really had a lot to bring, you know, since the early albums, that I had a lot to bring to the table, not just my ability, but my creative side. I felt like it was the first time we were all at peace with it. And there was no ego when we went in there. We drove out to Denver as a band, and we recorded as a band. It was really the first time ever, and it was just thankful that we got that.
Well, coming off of
the dark days,
the dark time, you know, Keep Them Confused, in my opinion, is there's some really great stuff in Keep Them Confused, but as what we were doing at the time. The music industry was changing so much, and I mean, that's around 2005, and we can just go down a laundry list of how the scope of things were changing at that time.
Yeah.
And so by the time we got to Feel Good, we had kind of realized that we just needed to go back to doing what we knew how to do, which was just playing songs, you know? And so I think, and what I mean by that is you can obviously see with Keep Them Confused, we were trying to maybe see if we could find a place in what was going on around that time. You know, I don't think we sacrificed ourselves musically by any stretch of the imagination. I just think like by the tours that we chose to do and things like that. And some of the things like that, but like what, you know, that's just trying to keep up with the Joneses, man, trying to stay in front of people.
Right. Yeah.
So I think there's nothing wrong with that. And we made good friends doing those things actually. So, but I think like, by the time we got to Feel Good, we just realized it was like, man, this is just what the band does. And we're really lucky to have a great songwriter and we're going to get behind this. And Tony made, I think, us all very aware. He was trying very hard to write the best songs he possibly could at that time, I think. And he didn't spare songs, you know, like when it was time for him to write songs, he wrote songs. Like we waited sometimes a long ass time for him to start songs, but when he was ready to write songs, he'd pump them out. But he was ready to write songs, he'd write songs. So he didn't waste songs, you know, by any means. So I think that was pretty evident.
So what you're saying is there's not a ton of B-sides.
No.
Exactly. There's none.
There is none, man. There is really none. Because, I mean, like, Rory would know from the experience of just being with Tony, like I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Ray, but it's like he wrote 12 songs. We recorded those 12 songs, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. Every time. There's never a song wasted.
Yeah.
And if there was a song wasted, it was before I ever saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. And the demo, man, I came across my, I just moved. And I still have all the cassette tapes from all those records.
Oh, really? Like, wow.
Have that's them cool. too.
Yeah.
The sky is still falling. Is there any end in sight? And some are talking to themselves as missiles fly through the night.
How did the band as a whole like the variety of acoustic songs and like other paced songs on this record that you guys were writing?
I thought it was great. I mean, I thought that acoustic element was always really cool. It kind of had, you know, we were all fans of that stuff anyways.
I would like to say that the acoustic songs are so good that how could you not like them? They're yeah. just, and I'm not to say that because I'm in the band, because his acoustic songs had a lot of feel. They had a lot of emotion to them and they got right to the point and hit you. And so when he said, I got this acoustic song, I think it would work in the album, they're all ears, you know? That was the one cool thing. And Matt always says this. He always says, he just couldn't wait to hear what the next thing Tony came up with. Mm-hmm. And that was the case with this album on every song. Just couldn't wait to hear what was next.
It was always nice to get those acoustic songs because they really did highlight Tony as a phenomenal songwriter. I mean, you know, the punk songs go by so fast and they're so loud that you don't always stop and appreciate, you know, the song structures and the great lyrics and stuff. But when you come in with those acoustic songs in Ontario, which is like a piano song, you really hear that he had an incredible knack for songwriting.
The melodies were so crazy. And like he used to always say too, at least with the things that he told me, were like, the trick was with a fast song, you had to have a really slow melody.
Mm. Hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Like he used to, and like I always thought that was cool because if you think about it on the songs that are really cooking, all those melodies that are really catchy or super slow.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Whenever these songs came up on one of our albums, acoustic or just, you know, something without drums, there's a reason for it. And there's definitely a lot of discussion of where it needed to go on the album.
Hmm, very cool.
In regards to yours to destroy, Rory, as a drummer, what's your reaction when someone in the band says, hey, we're going to use a drum machine here?
Suddenly, I see myself returning to the scene where I was ridden of this crime. Looking at the outline of the chalk drum on the...
That wasn't a drum machine. That was actually me at the beginning.
Oh, really?
And yeah, it they just tweaked the hell out of it. And there's something else that does that too. That's just something, well, another song that it was just so different. A song called Kill the Rich at the end of the album. It's kind of like a treat folky thing. Mm-hmm. Tony had just written that song. We knew what we were going to do. We hadn't really practiced it. So Tony's like, I'm going to tell you what to do, and you're just going to play it. I'm like, okay. And I listened, you know, he played it for me. I remember sitting down. He's like, this is what I wanted to do. I'm like, okay. So I go into the studio. I go into the room, the drum room, and he walks in there with me. And he's sitting next to me. I'm like, oh, you're going to tell me what to do.
You're really going to do that. Okay.
And he's like, he's sitting there and he's like, he's showing me where to hit the cymbals and telling me, which kick to do. I'm like, so he's literally sitting next to me while I'm playing that song the way he wants it.
Oh my God.
So there was a method behind the madness. And, you know, Tony was the brainchild behind it, which is, you know, it just took the guesswork out of it. For me, I could do anything I want. Tony would never say no or that's not a good idea. But when it came time to do it, it's like, what's the best thing for the band? What's the best thing for the song? What's the best thing for the band? And that's why setting the ego aside for this album, I think really just kind of, it's such a machine, it's such a unit that we did the best thing for the songs for the album.
The only way it seems.
Who was the trumpet player?
The trumpet player is Hefe, but the trumpet player is about a movie, isn't it? I think.
Yep, I believe so.
Yeah, but Hefe played that, didn't he?
I believe so. When we toured with him, he'd come up every night and play it. So I'm pretty sure he did. I don't even know if they recorded there, or maybe he recorded it and then sent it to them in his studio. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty positive it was him, but they're just one line.
Yeah, it's very quick.
But it's a damn good line, and it's in a really important part of the record. And every night when we would do it, and we just love playing that. You know, when we toured with NOFX, which we were fortunate enough to do a bunch of times, he'd come out, crowd go crazy, and he'd just do his one line and walk off. Yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah, I think that song like tells a pretty good story, and then when that trumpet comes in, it's just like, oh, that's cool.
I love that part. So were you guys at any point, like, you know, with the trumpets and stuff on it and the slower paces, were you ever like kind of like, oh, I wonder how people are going to receive this record?
I would like to say no, we were never like that. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like we were ever – I felt like we had everything. We've already proved what we needed to prove, and that's why the pressure was off. It's like the music industry was so strange, and we were such a weird time, and – you know, like, how much longer can we do this? It's been like 26-27 years.
Yeah.
And it's like, we're so happy to go into the studio. And I think just everyone was at peace with each other and accepted each other for who we were. And so I don't think, I mean, yeah, you want to write the best album you can and have the players that we had, and the lineup was so strong, but I don't think we were trying to prove anything to anyone except for ourselves. I feel like we were just really had something to prove to ourselves and make the best album we could. I remember going in thinking, let's try to make the best album we can, and having that conversation with everybody.
Yeah. So I'd read an interview with Matt actually once that the different sounds on this record stem from the music you guys liked. So what were some records you guys were listening to or influenced by while you were making this record?
Good question.
I'll throw you on the spot there.
I remember, I'm trying to think of what we listened to on the drive out, because we drove out together, but I know that, Tony always loved Elliott Smith, and he always loved the Beach Boys, and he loved the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
So those were like really, those were three ingredients that were really heavy in his world. You know, there's no doubt about that. I know that like for other records, you know, we would listen to certain records and maybe try to think of like, oh, we should try to get it to sound like this. This is a cool sound. But going to Bill in general kind of solved that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Everything Bill was doing at the time sonically just sounded really great. I still listen to the same crap that I listened to then. You know what I mean? Like, I don't listen to anything but 80s metal, man. Like,
nice. You know,
there's a place for that.
Like really old country guitar. Like I listen to really old country, like 50s guitar. And then I listen to like all the 80s classics. Like that's it. That's all I like them.
So are there any 80s inspired solos on this one? I'm trying to think.
Got away with a little bit, man. There was a whole discussion on one song about me using the front pickup at the end of the solo. Like it was this whole thing. Bill was like, you know, mm-hmm. is that two pedal or whatever? But I felt like my job was to kind of push that envelope. And I used to say that with Tony, is like, look, I'm not a punk rock guitar player. So like my job is to try to interject what I can. So maybe a little bit will creep into the mix and then it'll be a little bit different, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we would grind a little bit, but that's making records and that's fun, you know? So, I try to squeeze it in there, dude. I think it's inevitable.
I feel like at that time when we were getting ready to go in, we were kind of listening to past records that the Blasting Room had done the 5-10 years previous. There's a couple records that really stuck out. One was a Useless ID album. One was a Rise Against album. There's other bands that were doing it, and it just sounded so fresh, and you could hear everything, and it just felt like there was a comfort about everything they were doing, and the musicmanship was like, gosh, I didn't know that band was that good. Kind of that stuff. And there's quite a few albums that had come out at that time that we were going, wow, this is just so crisp and clean and everything is equal, and just felt the mixes were killer. And so I felt like that's the thing that I remember about going in. That's what I was listening to, is some of the stuff that was being played coming out of that studio. And boy, they just knew how to do it. They kept it fresh. Everything was sharp, crisp, clean, played well. Like everything was coming out of there. It's like so played so darn good.
And you know, the funny thing was, I didn't even know who Bill was. I never listened to his band ever. I never listened to him. I was the only one out of everybody that never listened to that stuff. I was like, who's Milo? Like, I didn't know anything.
Wow.
You know?
She's like, what's the big deal about this guy?
Everybody was so excited to see him. And I was too. But like, I remember sitting down with him and I was like, hey, Bill, I don't know who the fuck you are. and he goes, he's all, that's good. we'll work well together.
That's awesome.
Because I was like,
we'll get along just fine.
And it, I remember going in the room and there was that book, Rory, with him in it, and it's like him playing drums, and like I was just like, wow, okay. And like, you know, everybody's like, you need to know who this dude is. I'm like, I don't want to know who he is now. I'm here, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Like, get this over with.
I don't want to get nervous.
Which is the totally the opposite for me. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's Bill. He's playing all these bands that are so influential to me. And
yeah.
I, you know, I got to play gigs with him. I didn't really ever talk to him. I think I said hi to the, you know, we were friendly with the other guys in the band, but Bill was just so focused on being creative and being a great drummer and being who he was that he was just in his own world in a way. And then I was going to the studio. I'm like, boy, I hope I don't fuck up. I just don't want to mess up in front of Bill. I'm a drummer. He's a drummer. And what if, you know, he ends up playing my parts or something. I went in there. I was kind of scared.
What if he takes the sticks out of my hands?
Right. But then he was just like the best guy to have on your side. And like, you'd go to the studio, we'd be in the studio. He'd show up at 8. He's like, okay, let's do it. And he would give a, each of us would take a shot of, it was, I think it was called Gestapo coffee, this black espresso shot. So we'd do that, a shot of ginseng and a shot of ginger. And then we get to it, and it's just like you're just like, you know, just all ready to go. And then you do the date, and then it'd be lunchtime, and every day they'd order lunch, and they would order the spiciest food. They'd get Indian, Thai, or Mexican, and they say, make it as spicy as you can. I'm like, hey, Bill, I can't eat food that spicy. He's like, no, it's good. You're gonna be fine. Just eat it. And we'd be eating it, you know, all the engineers. And the band would be eating this food that was so spicy. And I remember we were just in this room, we were all sweating. And Bill goes, it's so great. It's like you're on hallucinogenics. I'm like, yeah, man, I'm fucking I'm tripping. Dying. It's so spicy. Like you're coming off the caffeine and ginger and ginseng high into food that was so spicy. And that's where those days are there. And they're just like, it's unlike anything you get to experience. And it just puts you in this place that you're just ready to do it.
Yeah.
They know all the stimulants.
Wow.
It's great.
And I guess it's no surprise they call it the blasting room for a reason, you know?
Yeah, there's no drugs or anything. It was just like, you know, stimulation of the creative thing. And you know, 8 dudes just making an album. And that's kind of was what it was. It wasn't just the band. Mm. It was like there's a whole team there supporting the band. You know, it was killer.
All with red fingers and runny noses.
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome. My way down to the city, I was looking at the window. As of what you learned to look the other way. We're so desperate, it's dangerous. We basically have lost our heads. Responsible for nothing, but taking credit. Right, so getting a little bit more into the themes and songwriting of the record. So this record was written during the final 2 years of George W. Bush's 8-year presidency. How much did America's dismal political landscape influence the writing of this album?
If anything around that time, you know, I'll speak openly about it. This is my opinion, and Rory, for sure, chime in on it. I think, like, we were kind of over it.
Mm.
As like over, like Mike had done, Fat Mike had done his thing,
yeah,
about trying to get him out of office and all this, and it didn't work. And I think we were just tired of all that crap, man. Like the and not that we were against what Mike was doing or anything like that. It's just like there was such a poignant fact about making music with your friends on this. Like when we drew, like, you know, I don't know if Tony was really thinking about what was happening so much at the time politically. I know that, like, Tony wrote from the hip and was really emotional with his songs. And I think that he was really good at taking things that he saw around him and putting poetic license on them to be relatable to you. So you could feel like that song was written for you or that song was written about you. Like, I think he was very observant, you know. So what he was observant about may have been political, but I don't know if it transferred so much into the music that way. I think it was more about relationships. I think it was more about friends. And I think about, like, the changing of friends over the time. Like, we were all, like, you know, being on the road and being around all these people for a long period of time, and everybody has the same habits. Like, you got to realize, we, to stay alive on tour, you start to change after a while. Like, you can't keep doing those things anymore. Mm-hmm. So, like, I think seeing around people around you become different, and you're still trying to keep your head above water. Tony really wanted to take care of us, and really wanted all of us to, like, have houses based off the band, and he wanted all of us to be, have families, and he really cared about us as people, and I think he carried that on his shoulders for this song. So I think his songs covered everything, dude. I don't know if they were necessarily political. I think he just really wanted us to be great, and I think it was everything. I don't know, you know. What do you think, Roy?
I think that's pretty accurate. I think we were all tired of politics, and it was an escape for us, this album, to just really have something to work towards and be a part of, and that's why we were all so deep in it, and we all dove 100% in. And the political climate sucked. A lot of things sucked. A lot of things were good, and the good was that we had this band, we had these songs, we had this album, we could go into the blasting room, and that was like our heaven. It's what we all did. It's what we all wanted. It's what we all loved. It's what we all grew up doing. It's what we knew. And so, despite all the things going on and how intense it was, it was just lucky that we had that, because if we didn't have that, we were working stiffs at the time, would have been probably just a sadder time, kind of like now.
Hmm. Well, I think we used to always say the same thing: what we put into it, we will get out of it.
Mm-hmm. We did say that.
Mm-hmm. And so, That was kind of the mantra, you know, like, if nobody was going to do us any favors. So we had to put the work in. And I think, like, as times are changing with the industry, sometimes you don't, you know, there's pressures there, right? Like, and this, me coming in later, when the band had kind of, you know, when Chris left and I joined the band had 1,000 people coming to the shows already. Mm-hmm. So, I wasn't there when Rory and Tony and Matt and Steve and all those dudes built everything, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think when things were at the most important of just like, hey, we don't care if people come to the shows. If we don't care what happens, we just have to make this really great album, because this could be the last album that we make. We don't know that or not, but we just have to make a really great album. And man, all the stars aligned on that. And sometimes they don't. Keep Them Confused was one that did not, you know. Mm-hmm. Still a great album, still mm-hmm. a cool thing, has some moments on it. Hard Rock Bottom, I think Hard Rock Bottom has some really huge moments. But Keep Them Confused was, like Rory said, all of us firing on the same page, really loving one another, being in the same room with each other, going out like teenagers, man, in a van. I mean, like, break, losing Rory's cell phone out the car window, you know.
One funny story that me and Dave every now and then, every couple of years, about talk about, we're in the middle of nowhere, driving overnight to the blasting room in Fort Collins, and we're somewhere in the Great Salt Flats, and there's one car charger. I'm like, hey Dave, can you charge my phone? He's like, yeah, sure, dude, no problem. And about an hour later, I'm like, hey, can you have my phone for a second? He's like, sure. And he grabs the cord. He goes, oh. So the phone had fallen out the door at the Great Salt Flats, and I didn't have a phone, and it was just the charging wire with a bunch of wires and no phone.
Just dangling.
So another thing that happened, so I got no cell phone, no big deal, it's just another distraction. I don't got a cell phone. The second day we're there, I'm like, you know, writing some emails to some people, and Tony's walking, you know, across the room, and I've got my cord from my computer, my only lifeline to the outside world, going from there to where I'm sitting, and Tony's looking at his computer or something and walking with a cup of coffee, and he trips over the cell phone or the power cord to the computer. The whole coffee drops on my computer. Oh. Gone. So I got no cell phone, no computer.
Oh man.
And Tony's like, oh my god, I'm so sorry, you don't have a cell phone and you don't have a computer. And Matt goes, what are you gonna do? I'm like, nothing, what can I do, no big deal. Matt goes, I can't believe you're so calm about it. I'm like, what am I going to do? I got an album to record here. So it was kind of a blessing in disguise. Dave losing my cell phone and Tony killing my computer. And yeah. I had nothing to do but focus on me, my drumming, the band. It was just it's a really funny point going into that. Just another thing that probably added to my playing. There's no distractions.
Yeah,
no,
that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody be said for that.
Yeah.
Oh, that was funny.
So then I went and drank myself into a
So you guys have already hit on a couple like memories of Tony and stuff throughout the your time playing. What are some things that stand out, either touring or just like off the cuff stuff that just like, you know, resonates in the back of your mind that you can never forget?
Oh man.
Yeah, I just honestly, like, I mean, the first thing, I just really think the shows, like, playing the shows were just a lot of fun, you know? I mean, like, that was what it was always about. Like, you waited around all day to play the show. So the show was always the most important thing. Because even if, I mean, when you spend that much time around each other, man, you know, it can get hairy.
It's a lot of togetherness.
Oh, we know that.
but I mean, you know, and that even with that, I think we managed just fine. I mean, like we all went through big things on the road individually, and we're all there to support each other. I went through a divorce on the road, like, you know, all like we all went through a lot of things, and we're there for each other in amidst all those crazy times, you know. But like playing the shows is just always the best part, you know, getting up and, you know, watching Rory bash away and Matt run around and sing his ass off, and, you know, Tony always trying to get in my way every time I jump. just you know, the little things that you can kind of expect. And I think, you know, when we would go to Japan and stuff, you know, those were like big, huge moments because it was like an alternate reality. Like the band, for whatever reason, just excelled over there. And so we would have, you know, difficulty walking around the streets, and then we'd all go home and go back to work, you know. It was just funny. So it was it's a different world. And I think we're very lucky to have done those things at the time that we did them in, because being the age that we were and all that kind of stuff. And especially now that the year that we've just all gone through, like we used to go to Europe twice a year, man, go to Canada twice, go to, you know, Japan and Australia twice, and like go to all these places and like play show 200 something shows a year. It's crazy. Wow.
That's awesome. That's a lot of shows.
There's the one thing. Through all the sacrifice and all the things the band did, the one thing we could all agree on is we just couldn't wait to play the gig. Whatever happened that day, just sat by the side, get up on stage, the band's a unit, let's have a great time. We love it. We love each other. Let's just have a great time. We tried to do that. It didn't always come across, but the business, the logistics of getting to where you're going to, the drama, all the stuff. As soon as you got on stage and together, none of it mattered. You had to be there in the moment. And it's just it was a great thing that we got to share as a band. And any band that gets to experience that knows what that's like. And I'm sure most of your listeners are in bands or play in bands or love bands. And it's just that one moment. It's like everything goes by the side. And it's just the one time you can let it all down and forget about it. And it's a real escape. And we did it for so long that it just made it easy for us to be there for that hour. We just knew that's what mattered. That's what we're doing. Here we are. Let's do it.
And I think the interesting thing is now it, like, you know, I play in a different format now. Like now I play with a country artist. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing about that is like people in this format are really fascinated with punk rock from that time period. Like a lot of guys, I have met some country people that I won't be that dude, but that have good names to them, that are like, you were no use for a name.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They were punk rock fans themselves. I think there was a lot of people that listened to punk rock that we didn't realize listened to punk rock, if I could say that fair enough. Like, I've met a ton of people, and like my singer that I play with now, like he's fascinated with a Warped Tour. He's just like, man, you did the Warped Tour. I can't believe you did that. That thing was like this fictional thing, like this mythical thing to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
And, you know, he doesn't have to worry about that kind of stuff, you know? But it's just like to him, he thinks back and he's like, man, that's just so cool that you did that. Like, I think that. And when I first started playing with him, all he could ask me about was a Warped Tour, you know, for like the first year that I played with him and what it was like playing in a punk rock band. So, and it's awesome. And he tells people about it all the time. He's like, man, he was in this punk band, you know, like, so I think, and I could not do what I'm doing now if it was not for Rory and everybody, like, you know, to play shows at that level. Like I could not do what I'm doing now if it wasn't for that, you know? So these things you carry with you forever. You know? So it's interesting to see. I think that's my only spin on it really. It's like, I think I'm surprised now to hear that like so many people were really listening to it. And I don't think we really realized it sometimes, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I will say, I think the albums, like not just this one, but all of them, and your guys' style was very influential to a lot of people.
That's nice, man. I appreciate it. I mean, it's cool. I mean, and Rory, it's all your fault you started.
Yeah, it's funny. Nice for Name got around, and we got around for a long time, and that was just the joy. That's kind of, the band never had goals, but the one thing the band, no matter who was in the band, we all loved to do was just play the show, play with the band. Let's get to record. Let's do it. Let's the thing that you start the band for, and I feel like we feel good record of the year. We finished the band the way it kind of started, just our love of being able to record and tour. We just toured so much. Even, I mean, we toured on this album. It was probably our most extensive touring. We went everywhere, and you know, Eastern Europe to all of Asia and things like that. And it just kind of worked out. Lucky for us, just you know, the experience, the time, the catalog we had, but. We just love playing gigs. It was the one thing that you could have to look forward to. You could make some cash. You could, you know, let loose. It was away from the, you know, the daily grind of just, you know, being home, wishing you could go on tour. And then all of a sudden you're on tour doing this album that you made. So Nice for Name did get around. It's funny when you come across people and they're like, were you in a band? For me, I live in the bubble of Truckee, California. So every now and then someone, you know, says, were you in a band? I heard you were in this band. And you say it, and they look online or something.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
That's you? Like,
it's not a big deal to me, but because I was living and I got to do it. But it, people are intrigued by it.
Yeah.
One thing that Nice for Name got to do is we got to do all the things a band could ever want to do, from late night shows to MTV to putting out albums, touring wherever you wanted, touring with whoever you wanted. And we got to tour some great bands, from music festivals to bands you looked up to, like Bad Religion, NOFX, yada yada. As a smoker, as I can see 100 little eyes racing to the finish for a consolation.
About it, the interesting thing about it too is like a punk band can go to Schweinfurt, Germany, and like Leipzig and all these different places and play shows and get 500 kids or maybe 1,000 kids and you know, go to Austria and all these places. But a lot of major artists can't do that. They don't go to like they stick to major markets. They go to like, you know, or they'll go to major places on the continent. They won't. So they don't get a chance to see a lot of certain places, you know, or they'll get a chance to go to a lot of places, and people don't realize that. Like, so you'll take a major artist and they might be doing arenas or whatever in the States, but they'll, I remember going and seeing like in certain places, like guys that were on their way up when we were like playing shows, and they would be doing arenas maybe in the States. And then we were playing way bigger places over in Europe than they were, you know?
That's amazing.
And so just because they weren't, and nobody in their genre ever came over to the continent, you know? So like there was these freedoms that we had because of the grind, like Rory said, playing with a lot of people and being young enough to throw caution to the wind and just go for it was really made it extra special too, I think, because we got to see a lot of stuff and play a lot of shows. And, you know, you see these people, I just was thinking of that Tilt show. Remember that, Rory? And, we're in Holland somewhere with the smoke machine, and we're all like glass smoke machine.
Code four. So a funny thing, code four was a lot of most clubs in Europe had a smoke machine. A lot of time the smoke machine was connected to like a garage door opener, like remote thing. So you would be like, where's the smoke machine? And you would somehow, you know, always say, when we say code four, just let that smoke machine rip. They played a song at the end of the song and be like, code four.
The thing that did a big turnout to the show. So everybody, like what we did is we had, because there just wasn't a good turnout that there was a weird part of where we were. And everybody, so we were doing that and we couldn't even see in front of you. There's so much smoke. And the guys from Tilt were hitting fruit from the backstage with baseball bats. And bats
on the stage.
Wow. On the stage while we were playing tunes. So like Rory's just getting sprayed with fruit.
Just pummeled with That's amazing. That's a crazy story. In your ashtray is the answer to all the questions that you have.
I just want to emphasize that going into this, I felt it was a of the 27 years that I was lucky enough to do Know Your Name and all the albums, that this one was the most comfortable and felt the most organic. And I was just happy walking away. There wasn't anything I'd want to change on my part. And that never happens. And there wasn't anything I would do different. It was just so well, luckily, you know, fell into place. And that just doesn't happen. It's very rare. So I'd like to say thanks a lot for talking about this album, because because the band isn't a band anymore. Know Your Name isn't a band anymore. It's just like when someone comes up to you and say, you know, it's a great album and let's talk about it. And I do want to talk about it, because I felt it was such a conscious effort to do the best we could. And I always want to do the best I could, but not only did I feel going in that I was going to do the best I could, that everyone just did the best they could and played the best they could. And there was no ego. We went in, we came out clean, and then we got to do a tremendous amount of touring. And you know, that's the story, you know, how that's kind of went and finished off on this album.
Yeah, it was a good, like, I think that there's some defining No Use for a Name records, no doubt. Like, you know, Leche, and there's just some huge moments in the band's history prior to myself and, you know, all of that. I think Feel Good is a perfect record to play for somebody if they're like, hey, you know, I always feel like the live record and Feel Good are like the two good representations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, the high water mark for the songwriting and the energy from the live show, you know? And so really, I just feel like I feel lucky to be even a part of it. Really. That's the only thing I can say, you know, looking back on the whole thing. And you got to remember that, hopefully, when you're in these moments, you don't ever really realize what's going on. You're just trying to be in them. So it's cool to look back like this and have you guys appreciate it, because at the time we were just trying to not, you know, suck.
Pretty simple. You know, yeah.
We're just doing the best we could and trying to represent Tony the best we could, because he'd worked so hard on those songs.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a huge thing. Like, that's a big deal, especially for looking back and remembering a body of work by somebody who is no longer here. Like, Tony really took it serious. He really cared about it. And it was fun to play his tunes. And you can hear that on this record.
Definitely. This record is such an achievement. And it's been amazing to hear you guys talk about it and how it really was a collaborative effort between everybody in the band. I think that makes it even better. Wish we had more albums and more albums and more albums, but if we had to end with one, this is just a great way to end it. What a great legacy, a superb record.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. I agree.
Is there any truth to the rumor that it was almost titled The Other White Album?
Wow.
I know. Crazy, right?
I don't know that. I don't know that. We had a whole list of them, though.
Yeah, I think I read an interview. Someone in the band made that joke, I guess. I read that. I laughed.
I remember hearing that. That's just a funny thing that it got, like, how somehow that came out of the bedroom that we probably were laughing at, making a joke about album titles, and somehow the Other White Album, you know, because we were talking about the Beatles.
Right.
And I can't even believe that someone had heard that. I remember that now. It's just hilarious that somehow there was a fly on the wall.
That was the era of, like, Matt getting into home video and, like, you know, like all the video. If for anybody listening to this, there's plenty of video documentation online of, like, us rehearsing, being in the studio, video montages and all of this. Like, Matt got through that studio time making video montages.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, there's definitely a bevy of those kind of things. And so I think our sense of humor could have been tortured.
Was it one of those instances where you just had the camera rolling all the time trying to make stuff happen?
Yeah.
There were some good little video montages in there. You know, you gotta find ways to occupy yourself.
All right.
Matt was really creative with these video montages. He would just find something to focus the energy on, and he would just run with it. And they were just so ridiculous. And then he would piece them together, edit it, and then he would put it out there. Just, you know, at the time, putting it in the interwebs was, you know, fun, and they got a lot of views. And they were just ridiculous. And you didn't know if it was serious or not sometimes.
Yeah.
It was never. But yeah, Matt put a bunch of those out.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us about a point in our lives that we really enjoy.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours, guys. Thank you so much for making time to chat with us about this record. This has been an absolute thrill for Craig and I. I know I speak for Craig when I say that. Real thrill. We are super, super psyched to have this opportunity.
Yeah, I talked to Dave last week. I was just excited that I was going to get to do it with Dave and do it with you guys, because I think this is the third time we're doing it now.
Yeah,
yeah, we got to game plan another album, Roy.
Yeah,
I just knew it was a good time, and Dave's like one of my best friends, and I shared a room with Dave for 10 years. You know, why do we share a room, Dave? Why were we the ones that were always put in the same room together?
Because we were always up early, man. You guys were always the ones that got up early, it's funny. It was always
you obnoxious early birds in the other room.
Yeah,
Rory would wake up, and Rory, you'd wake up early. I'd wake up early. And then we would always, Rory and I were the ones that did stuff. Those dudes were lazy. That's the problem. I had been in the band like 2 days, and Rory had me like at an airport shuttle, like cleaning in an airport shuttle,
Yeah.
The funny thing was, like, the joke we had in the band a lot was like, yeah, you guys are lazy. They would call us lazy. Like, Tony and Matt were the team against me and Dave. It wasn't against, but Tony and Matt would share a room. Dave and I would share a room. Mm-hmm. We would wake up, the day would be half over by the time they woke up. It'd be 10. We'd be like, come on, you guys, the day's half over. Let's go. And they'd be like, ugh. And so they wouldn't share a room with us because we would, we did sometimes, but we would just wake up early and go for a walk or eat breakfast together, or even practice together or go to the beach or whatever. And those guys, just their time was different than ours. And so Matt did not want to share a room with me. And Tony, they were just on a different time schedule is no big deal, but that's why I got to share a room with Dave for 10 years. It just made sense, and Tony and Matt were rooming together, and usually we're up together all at 4 o'clock, and just me and Dave were still waking up at 8 for whatever reason, and guys would be sleeping until 10 or 11, so we would wake up, and Matt and Tony would be like half asleep, and they're like, you guys are lazy, because we
you guys are already halfway through your day.
Sarcastically, they're like, oh, you guys are lazy. I'm like, no, you guys are lazy.
That's funny.
Tony was a sloth, man. That was it. Tony used to just sloth around. He'd just like sit in the room, just like hang out.
Yeah. Tony's nickname with us was the sloth. He just kind of moved slow in the morning until he got some coffee in him. And we were all, me and Dave would be 4 cups in.
Yeah. Oh, you're only in a cruise cup?
Like before the tour bus going everywhere in a Cruise America RV.
Yeah. Mm. many a year in a Cruise America RV. Man, that was rough.
All right, guys.
Well, cool, guys.
Totally appreciate it, guys. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today.
Yeah, buddy.
Thanks for having us. Jeb, Craig, thank you very much. Good luck with the interview, and we'll talk again.
All right. Awesome, man. Well, yeah, we're gonna keep bugging you until you tell us to go away. So.
Oh, good. Thanks, Craig, guys. Dave, I'll talk to you later, too. Have a good one. Nice to have you here with me.
All right, buddy.
Thanks so much, guys. We really appreciate it. But the light that keeps on burning is on the same page you've been turning. Ignorance for some is just a way of life. There is no message I am sending. All right, and there you have it. Our conversation with Rory and Dave from No Use for Your Name. What an awesome opportunity.
That was so cool. I personally enjoyed them going back and forth about different stories. It's kind of cool to hear, the insider's take on, life in a recording studio and what they were doing.
Yeah, what a great opportunity for them to just share stories and talk to each other about a thing that they did together. And I think what made it extra special is, we recorded this episode on Tony Sly's 50th birthday, which is pretty cool.
That's pretty rad, nice little tribute right there.
Definitely. Well, we'd like to thank Rory and Dave for coming on the show today and talking about this record with us. Craig, I would like to thank you for all the many things that you do for this podcast.
Oh, thanks, Jed.
Chief among them, hanging out with me and talking about this record today.
Yeah, cheers, buddy.
I'd like to thank Kristen Makes of Less Than Jake for the theme music. And I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Talking Records for an hour and listening to us overanalyze this stuff. We do it because we love it, and we hope that it makes your next listen to these albums even better. Make sure you check us out on the socials. Please say hello, suggest albums, tell us your stories. How did you get in to Noise for a Name and Feel Good Record of the Year?
Don't forget to rate and review. Leave us a positive note. It goes a long way. Thanks.
All right, everybody. Take care.